you've got a year's worth of how ibuprofen is discussed on Twitter. Mm-hmm. That goes into Relative Insight, and then you can say, you know what, I want to understand how that differs over time. Mm-hmm. And then what you can do with the data, say, okay, just give me Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4, mm-hmm. and then hit a button and we'll tell you the differences.
Welcome to AI for Business Growth, the podcast from pioneering artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all business people, from startup entrepreneurs right through to Fortune 500 companies. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech to help you and your business to navigate through and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow businesses.
Today's show is about uncovering hidden insights from language data that will help you boost your results using artificial intelligence. A lot of decision making relies on quantitative data, which will tell you what is happening, but taking effective action requires you to know the how and the why. In a lot of language data, both within companies and online, like social media data, survey data, email data, like all language data, there's often hidden insights in that data that can actually be very time-consuming and messy for humans to find. But also humans can miss these things that could be the vital insight that you need to change your results. My guest today, Ben Hookway, is the founder and CEO of Relative Insight, which is a company that makes it fast and easy to identify these hidden insights. So welcome to the show, Ben.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you. Before we get into it all, could you perhaps get into a bit about your background and how you came to found Relative Insight?
Well, my background really has been in B2B technology of all types. So I've basically always kind of commercialized, I would say, clever technology under the hood, and then brought that to life via B2B apps mainly. So the first part of my career mainly was in the States. Spent 6 years in the States, was fantastic, and then sort of came home and then founded a mobile phone software company, which took me to Asia a lot. Sold that company, and that company was venture capital backed. And so if you make venture capital people money the first time, they tend to come back to you over and over. And so that's kind of why I've been sucked into this perpetual CEO role. And then they introduced me actually to the original founders of Relative Insight when it was still a research project at Lancaster University. And then the story went on from there.
So how were they using it at Lancaster University?
Yeah, so the original use of Relative Insight was actually in law enforcement. So our job was to catch people masquerading online. And in particular, we did a lot of work in child protection. Mm-hmm. So the job we were designed to go at was, how do you know if someone's really a 13-year-old girl online and not a 40-year-old man doing a very good impression of a 13-year-old girl? Now, that's a difficult problem, I guess, in mm-hmm. all kinds of aspects. But from a data point of view, it's actually very tricky, because the bad guys are extremely good at it. Mm-hmm. So if you were to take suspect language and put it through a standalone text analytics algorithm, mm-hmm. it will probably tell you it's a 13-year-old girl, because the bad guys are like 95, 96% perfect. So that was the problem we were designed to figure out. And so the way we did that is that we came up with a comparative approach. So mm-hmm. what we would do is get databases of verified language from the police and the security services. So say verified 13-year-old girl language. Yeah. And then you get suspect language. And what you actually want to do is compare them. And our output was the 5% difference or the 4% difference in the language. Mm-hmm. And it's the differences that would catch people. It's not what they say.
Yeah.
Right. It's the differences. And this is kind of true, I guess, when you think about it. Like, I mean, anyone who's kind of listening to me and has got any knowledge of text analytics or any type of analysis, they're not actually listening to anything, to everything I'm saying from first principles. They're kind of thinking of what they already know, and they're trying to figure out what is Ben saying that's different from what I already know. So this differences approach is core to everything we do, and it helps sort of get some good results in the law enforcement world and contribute to some sort of bad people being locked away. And it now forms the basis of everything we do in relative insight in the commercial world.
It's amazing. I mean, I love that initial application, but it must have been a strange transition moving from that kind of law enforcement application to boosting company results. How did that transition happen?
Well, we were looking around for, I mean, obviously the security world is a very complicated, opaque, weird world. So, I mean, we've been quite successful there, but then we also had the opportunity to think about, well, how else could we look at it? And what happened was we were, you know, just the networks getting in touch with marketing agencies actually quite a lot who were using, this is several years ago when maybe social media listening was just coming out, and a word cloud was kind of the height of of sophistication. And we sort of came across this and we were like, well, we can do better than that with one, you know, asleep with one arm tied behind our back, you know. So it seemed like a really obvious thing to get to go and look at. What was tricky, I've got to say, that the tech's kind of easy, but the hard bit is kind of learning a brand new industry. And particularly the early days in agencies was kind of tricky, because unless you, until you know how the money flows in any industry, you quite often make the mistakes of, you know, having the wrong pricing point or you're going after the wrong people. So that took quite a while. But then, you know, we got the right help on board, we got our first customers in, and then kind of from there it really sort of soared.
Wow, really interesting. And then so now that you're in the marketing space, what kind of problems do you solve for your customers?
Yeah, so we get used mainly in two applications. So one is consumer analytics or market research type world. And then the other is customer experience type world. So a few examples from the, say, consumer analytics world. So this is quite an old example. It was one of the first projects we worked on, actually, out of law enforcement. So this was for a cosmetics company in the States, and they were struggling to penetrate into a younger demographic. And so what we did was that we got their data, which was reviews, so open ends in reviews. Okay, so how do people talk about cosmetics in North America? And then what we did is that we split that data up. So almost all text data comes with metadata attached to it. And so what we did was we took time as the metadata. We split the data up into how people in their 20s talk about makeup and how people in their 40s and 50s talk about makeup. And then you compare them. And like 85% was exactly the same, which is as you would expect, but it's the differences that are interesting. So there was things like people in their 20s tended to say they wear makeup, and people in their 40s and 50s tended to say they apply makeup. So now that's quite, that sounds almost trivial, actually, but it's actually really, really important to understand those differences, because you can be saying the wrong thing to the very target that you were, the target audience that you're trying to resonate with. So that's one example.
What was what happened when, before we go to the next one, when you pointed that out to them, I assume they changed their those specific words in their marketing campaign. And what happened after that? Was there a vast difference in how what kind of results they got?
So it was successful. It was it's always a bit opaque to us to put it this way, success is many parents, and or failure is an orphan. Is that a nice phrase? So, particularly when you when it was a multi collaboration project, and you know, the result was a good one for the brand in the end. And they did a lot more than just sort of started saying wear rather than apply. They actually started. We did other things like how they position next to, say, cosmetic surgery. We had you position next to natural ingredients. And so there's a lot of things actually came out. And you know, they repositioned a lot of their products. So
yeah,
that was a great success, that one.
That's really interesting. Do you have another examples from a different industry or a different type of company?
Yeah, I mean, we got that was a pretty typical consumer analytics space, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, what that really is about is how did two different audiences talk about the same thing,
yeah.
but what are the subtle differences in how yeah. they talk about it? That's pretty typical. And that gets done by, it could be how do people talk about my brand versus my competition? Mm-hmm. Or how do people talk about macro trends like sustainability? And how is mm-hmm. that changing over time? So we do quite a lot of time differences.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like standard for us. And so we get used by Nespresso and Prudential and Sky and, you know, a lot of like really big companies to do yeah. that kind of stuff. And then the other element is consumer experience analytics.
That's a big area, yeah.
Yeah, so how do you answer the phone, live chat, social interactions, and so on and so on. And this can be, you know, really, really, like, can really fascinating place. So,
yeah.
First of all, the results tend to be, for example, a good outcome live chat versus bad outcome live chat. You compare them and you can see what the linguistic attributes of consistently bad outcome live chats tend to be.
Interesting.
And then you can train people and you can resolve the problem. And on top of that, we can also say, actually, it's not just this linguistic attribute, it tends to be used by, you know, these 20% of your agents, and those are the ones you actually need to train.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also kind of subtleties like, let's say you're an internet service provider, and somebody says, my internet's down, another customer says, my Wi-Fi's down, and another person says, I can't connect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do those linguistically, those all sound like exactly the same problem, but it turns out quite often it's not the same problem.
Yeah.
So understanding the linguistic indicators of the problem is really, really important, because you you cut down the time to solve the problems. You cut down the time to solve the customer's problem dramatically. Mm-hmm. And actually, people then develop self-serve resources that if they say, I can't connect, well, that means this is the problem and they can fix it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all, you know, we just
really,
go on.
Really valuable for call centers then as well.
We do a lot of customer service. And I think it's also like, it's call centers and things like that, but it's also just the way brands communicate and help their customers in general, not just in call centers.
Of course, yeah.
And actually, there's also like emerging trends coming now where with the collapse of cookies, for instance, third-party cookie audiences are no longer really going to be relevant. And so the first-party data that brands have on their customers is really important, not just for CX, but for consumer analytics too.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of consumer analytics practitioners investigating CX data for more strategic trends.
Interesting. And so what kind of language data can you use? Is it any language data? What would you normally
use? Yeah, okay. Yeah, great question. So language data, text data, we're completely agnostic. So we lie on top of the data assets that people already have. Now, they tend to be social media is key, forums, review data.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing an awful lot right now in open-end surveys.
Okay, nice, because that's so much harder to do if you have humans, so much more expensive and harder if humans are actually
exactly
doing
right.
It.
Yeah. And so funny enough, this is like part of your earlier question about like what was it like trying to learn a new industry. Well, this is kind of one of the things we learned, is it?
Yeah.
Open-end questions aren't used in surveys that often because historically they've been very expensive and problematic to analyze. So people tend not to put them in, but a lot of our customers are now putting them in because let's say it's a customer satisfaction survey, and you've gone from 6 to 5. Well, the number tells you what's happened. You've dropped.
Yeah.
But it's the difference in the open-end text answers from when you were a 6 to when you were a 5. The difference in the language tells you why you've dropped from a 6 to the 5.
Interesting.
And so that's kind of open-ended survey. It is really common. We're doing a lot of transcription. You know, voice is becoming really big sort of UX medium now. So we're doing a lot of voice transcriptions of all kinds of things. Internal messaging, Slack, email. You name it, we analyze it.
It's incredible. And so when you were building this, I assume you used a huge amount of language data to get the accuracy that you've got. But if someone had a very small amount of language data, say they had like a handful of review sites or something, would it still give you that kind of identify the differences?
Yeah. So, you know, we tend to say that the sort of minimum number of words that you want is probably about 1,000.
Wow, that's really little.
Which isn't that much. So to put that in context, for those who are into books, like the average novel is about 110,000 words.
Yeah.
Okay. War and Peace is about 570,000.
Yeah.
Every Harry Potter book end to end is 1,000,000 words. So 1,000, the way our system works, it will compare 1,000 with 1,000, and it will show you the statistically meaningful differences. Now, what all that happens is that if you were to compare 100,000 with 100,000 words, you'll get more results, but that's only because the data set is bigger and it gives us more statistical confidence.
Okay.
So the system kind of only gives you results which are statistically valid. And so as data sets come down, we just automatically adjust it.
Okay, interesting. And then what about, so it seems that having two groups is really, really critical. So you're either looking at, you know, pre-post-COVID, or I don't know if there is such a thing as post-COVID, actually.
Yeah.
Millennial versus Gen Z, or, you know, different age groups or different jobs. Like in my world, you know, an endocrinologist versus a cardiologist, for example.
Yeah.
So, you know, it seems that's really important, which is interesting. Is there a particular kind of project that is your favorite that you do, that your company does?
God, that's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that. I think that the things I really like, I think there's two examples.
Yeah.
So one is the way that professionals in a certain industry think they talk the same way as each other and they don't. And actually you reference healthcare there.
Yeah.
And that is an absolute classic. Like, we do this quite a lot. We do quite a lot of healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And the way a pharma company talks about a condition, the way a primary care physician talks about a condition, and the way the specialist talks about a condition, and then the way the patient talks about a condition are all over the map.
Yes.
And you very often you see these instances where somebody thinks they're saying the right thing and it's resonating, and it's just it's completely different to the way that the other group is talking. And it's that always, I love that, because it really shows, I guess, kind of doing the world some good, like it's how to better communicate. I think my other favorite one is probably brand differentiation. So either the way brands talk or the way people talk about the brands. So let's say, for example, you're a supermarket.
Mm.
You know, most people would think that, well, the way people talk about supermarkets is kind of, it's a supermarket. You know, how variable can it be?
Mm.
But we have certain tools which give us multi-comparisons. We can give you a heat map of the differences of, say, 6 supermarkets against the other 6.
Wow.
And you'd be amazed at how different how differently supermarkets are discussed, actually, in quite fundamental ways by consumers. So that always shocks a customer.
Yeah.
They think there's a conventional wisdom in a company or in an industry that this is the way it is. And then you show them the data and it's like blows it out of the water. And then the similar thing there is how brands talk.
Yeah.
People often, and if you put the effort into really creating a brand and the emotional energy into the copywriting and the tone of voice and this type of stuff, you know, you naturally think you've done a really good job and you're saying all the right things. But actually, when you do a data-driven analysis of that, it's really surprising how little brands are actually differentiated from each other. Like retail banking.
Yeah.
You know, savings accounts, mortgage, trust, integrity, ethics, local.
Yeah.
Insert brand here. You know, that is that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And
it's only when you show the data that people understand the problem.
That's so amazing. I saw this really interesting study that was comparing how brands in the same area are compared differently. And that I was really looking at for pharmaceuticals, but it showed that Starbucks versus Dunkin' Donuts was vastly different. And I bet your data would come up with a lot even around that. Whereas drug brands in exactly the same space as perceived by consumers was pretty much the same. You know, they weren't differentiating it properly because they weren't doing the analysis properly.
Yeah. So similarly, actually, we've done, even if you think about ibuprofen.
Mm.
So when people are talking about the name ibuprofen, as opposed to like a brand name version of ibuprofen, how do they talk? Like, what do they, do they perceive it as differently? Do they talk about different pain? Do they, you know, and it's quite staggering how different it is, actually. And quite one interesting thing is, parents will tend to buy ibuprofen, vanilla ibuprofen, for themselves. But if it's for their kid, they'll tend to buy the brand name.
That's nice. That's because the perception of the brand name is that it's slightly better. That's
correct.
Interesting. And it's what you were saying about the patients versus the pharmaceutical company versus the doctors really strikes home for me, because it reminds me of a project we did quite a long time ago, but it was about a rare disease drug. And we were trying to use, well, we were using artificial intelligence to find these patients from face recognition. But what was really interesting, that what you said really reminds me so much of, was that we had the clinical trial data, we had the marketing data, but when we met parents of these children, they weren't talking about any of the things that the pharmaceuticals or the doctors were talking about. They were talking about potty training. Because these children were born with the condition and had an inability to potty train until they were treated because they had issues. And, until we started searching for that, we were having trouble finding, you know, how to get how to get them. It was the potty training. It's so interesting. And your stuff would have helped us so much faster.
Yeah, we see this. I think this is, in medical, this is really important. So, and we've done several projects around this. So if you have... let's say you want to look at people with, say, debilitating heart conditions, for instance, and you've got a particular drug. And like, so you tend to focus on the condition and the medical aspects of that.
Yeah.
But if you look at the language of people in a forum which is dedicated to that topic and that condition, the things which are most important to them are the implications of the condition on the rest of their life. So potty training in your case, right? So like not being able to spend time with kids or not being able to spend time with family. And actually, by understanding those aspects, you can resonate with people a lot, lot more, because that's what they actually care about.
That's what means something,
Exactly
them.
Right, yeah.
Wow, so interesting. And then what about things like human resources? Does it help in that space at all?
Yeah, so... this is something we've been pulled into quite a lot recently. Employee opinion surveys are a classic. So, you know, employee opinion's really been done the same way for, you know, decades. And, you know, you've got your annual, you know, you've got your quarterly review, or you've got your annual employee opinion survey, and tick box 1 to 5.
Yeah.
And there's always that open end, which people might take seriously, they might not, but... Mm. We've seen some really interesting results about people looking at the differences in the open ends depending on the metadata. So, for example, how do partners in a consulting firm fill that in compared to with managers or directors or junior employees? Or how do people in audit respond compared to people in business consulting?
Mm-hmm.
Or people in the Manchester office compared with the London office, for instance.
Yeah.
And so you can really understand local issues actually very, very well by doing that, which you wouldn't normally get just by looking at the quantitative data.
Interesting. And then a lot of the listeners aren't techie, so they may be thinking this is great, but how do I actually, you know, how difficult is this to use? So could you maybe take us through, you know, how once someone engages with you, how they actually use the tool?
Yeah, sure. So we are a software as a service, so you can either use it completely yourself or we can help you out with it as well. We just don't sort of give you the software and say, see you later. We will help you out. So step one is understand what areas you're interested in, okay, in terms of answering questions. Step two is understand what data sources you have from a text point of view. So is it social data or is it, do you have lots of survey open ends? So identifying that the data is key.
Yeah.
And then just by doing those two things, it's quite simple to then just upload that data into Relative Insight. And then conceptually, what we do is really easy. Okay. So let's say you've got social media of, you've got a year's worth of how ibuprofen is discussed on Twitter. That goes into Relative Insight. And then you can say, you know what? I want to understand how that differs over time. And then what you can do with the data, say, okay, just give me Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4. And then hit a button and we'll tell you the differences, the linguistic differences between those. It's pretty straightforward, actually.
How quickly does it process that data? Does it depend on the quantity of data or?
Yeah, we're talking, worst case, you're talking minutes.
Worst case.
Yeah, it's really quick, yeah.
That's amazing. And then what about languages? Obviously English. Do you support any other languages?
Yeah, so we support German. We support all the other Latin-based alphabet, so Spanish, Portuguese, things like
French,
that.
French, yeah.
Yeah, French. And then we're just working on Japanese, actually, right now, as Asian, first Asian character set. So, you know, most of our customers are UK, US, and that sort of 60% of the business actually comes out of the US. So, so it's mainly English, quite a lot of German, Spanish, things like that.
Wow, interesting. Japanese is an interesting one because you've got, 10,000 kanji, then you've got the hiragana and the katakana. In some ways, Chinese might have been an easier one to start with because you've only got one, you know, one script. You've only got kanji.
Yes, but there's some kind of, there's some bespoke customer demand for Japanese.
Certainly in my industry, yes.
Yeah, and so, and also as a kind of, I think as an entry point into that market, it's, I think, potentially slightly easier for us to go into Japan, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I guess because the clients give you their data or data from a social listening platform, you probably don't have any issues with privacy laws and GDPR, et cetera?
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. So because the data is the customer's data in most cases.
Yes.
So the customers have basically given permission for that data to be stored by that company. And so we're just an extension of that company analyzing it. Yeah.
Wow. So interesting. And I know that you have a lot of language facts at your fingertips. Could you maybe leave us with one or two nuggets?
I think I'll do one. So I'm sorry to anyone listening who's a bit, who's not very technical, but this one I love.
Okay.
And so there's a statistical relationship. It's called a ZIF distribution, okay? And it sounds very sciencey, but it's actually quite simple. And it's an explanation of why things are a long-tail curve. So, for example, in most developed countries, whatever the size, the population size of the capital city is, the next biggest city tends to be half. And then the third city tends to be half of that. So if you've got 10 million in your capital, your next second city tends to be 5 million, and then the next is 2.5. Well, language is exactly the same way. It works exactly the same way. So if you take 1 million words, the most commonly used word, let's say it's the. The next most is, let's say it's being used 100,000 times, the next most commonly used word will be 50,000 times. And then the next most common word is 25. And so it really tails off. So to put that in perspective, there's 171,000 words roughly in the English dictionary. But 50% of whatever we read or say is made up of just 170 of those 171,000 words.
Wow, that's a bit disturbing, isn't it?
It's just the way language works, because it's all the basic building blocks. And then it's this is why the subtle differences are so key.
Yeah. I'm going to have to enrich my vocabulary and keep track of that, I think. So thank you so much. This has been amazing. I find your tool really fascinating. And I also think it would be really powerful for rare disease because we don't have much data in other ways on rare disease. So if anyone would like to find out more about this tool, please visit relativeinsight.com and you can also get a demo. So thank you so much, Ben. I really appreciate your time today. This was really very interesting.
That was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Business Growth with Dr. Andre Bates. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your business, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating wherever you download your podcasts. For more information on the subjects covered in this episode, links mentioned during the conversation, or to connect with Dr. Andre, click the link in the show notes now. Plus, make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.